Okay, we are recording. You may chat amongst yourselves. Yes.
Why are you a bad person?
We're starting off philosophical.
There are many reasons why I might be a bad person. What were you thinking of in particular, or did you just want to get me to like unload some emotional trauma?
I don't know. I just thought to myself, why do you always just take advantage of mine and Charlie's good nature?
Because exploitation is the foundation of capitalism.
Exactly. And,
unfortunately, you're on the receiving end. There's nothing that can be done.
See, James gets it. It's capitalism's fault, not mine.
You know what? That's fair enough.
Hey!
When the system is against you, you know, you can only rail against it for so long.
You can. And originally I was railing against it, Lou. I was with you and Charlie all the way back at the beginning. Didn't do any of this stuff. I asked you if you were ready all the time. And then capitalism took hold.
Yeah, then you get a glimpse of that money, you're like, ooh.
Capitalism took hold, Lou, and I had to. I'm afraid that I had to.
Like some sort of plasticky, papery virus.
Yes, exactly. It depends on what country you come from, because sometimes I think that in some countries they're still just paper. But
or linen. I don't know.
Linen. I've not paid for anything with linen cash before, so I don't.
Well, I think it's quite deceptive because it feels like money. Like, sorry, it feels like paper money, but. And it's actually not made of paper per se, but fibers, and I don't know. I'm not qualified to comment. Speaks the Bank of England.
I'm just thinking about what linen money would look like.
You could literally sleep in money. You could just sew some money together as a blanket and be like, this is the warmest and most comfortable I've ever felt. You could really enjoy it. Does that sound like a good idea? I don't. If it's money, you'd probably just spend it on like actual bedding, though, wouldn't you?
that amount of money, I don't know what I'd spend it on.
How many pound? What would be the minimal? Like £5 note, right? How many £5 notes do you think you need to sew together to get a decent set of linen for your bedding?
Well, that's the question of the age, isn't it?
It is.
I don't know. I've actually bought some bedding recently, and I've already forgotten how much it costs.
I think it depends on where you get it from and stuff. Like, you can get decent, like a decent set for like 20 quid, right? Like a semi-decent set from like Wilko's for 20 quid or something.
Yeah, certainly less than you would... that you than the amount of £5 notes you would need.
Yeah, I imagine
considerably.
So.
In fact, but I imagine you'd need about 200 £5 notes, which would be money more than that.
Like a whole bed. You wouldn't even need. You're just buying a mattress for that.
True.
Mattress or well, no, mattress. Mattress are expensive. Mattress or a frame. Let's say a frame. You'll buy a frame, bed frame for less than 200. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's been a while.
Yeah, that's definitely doable.
Bed, to be fair,
mattresses do feel quite extortionate.
It's. Do you know what pisses me off about beds and buying beds is that everything comes separate. Like, I'm not.
As in you can't buy a bed and a mattress. You mean?
Yeah, no. You have to buy a bed and a mattress separately, right? You can't just go. I want them. I'm not gonna. If I'm buying a bed, I don't want just the frame. I want everything. I want a bed. I want a mattress. I want cushions. I want duvets and stuff. What? I understand they sell them separately so that, you know, if you want to just replace the mattress or you just want to replace the bed, I guess. But I want it all. Why is there no good deals?
Why can't you just get the whole package when you're shopping for a bed?
Exactly. You have to doss about and find a frame and find a nice mattress and all sorts of. Oh, it's just pain.
I think it's possible, but it's few and far between for sure.
It's a weird one. It's a weird one. Don't know why they do it. I do. Money. It's the answer. That's why they do it. That's why they do it.
The lowest common denominator of all.
That's why we do all things. Money. Fucking hell, that's depressing.
That's fucking lights off.
Let's shut up and move on with this facade. Oh.
Adam.
Yes.
I need your help.
Why?
I need your help quite badly.
What have you done?
So, I'm trying to figure out how I can play a copy of Persona 3.
Uh-huh.
And it looks like I have to buy an old console.
What phone do you have?
What phone? I have a Samsung Galaxy S21.
Wow, that's so many S's.
It's 21 S's. How are you with illegal forms of playing video games?
This is a trap.
This is a trap, yes.
Okay, I may know a friend.
I may know a friend.
Who may... I know a friend of a friend.
Mm.
Who may be okay with such concepts and might not find such concepts to be too big of an issue.
Do you have a controller that connects to your phone, either via Bluetooth or by connecting it?
No, he does not.
No, he does not. Okay, your friend might need one of them, because there is a thing such as an emulator, and if you find a way to emulate PlayStation Portable games, you can absolutely play Persona 3 Portable on your mobile phone. Portable, as the name suggests. How impressive. Otherwise, you probably have to wait until whenever it is that the game comes out on like PC and Game Pass, which is sometime next year?
I'll look at that. Like, Persona 5 Royal's coming to Steam.
Yes, it's coming out in October, right? We're not in October yet, are we? No, we're not. Okay, cool. Yeah, it's coming out in October.
I almost have no reason to own a PS4 anymore.
True. Most of the PS4 games should be available elsewhere.
That is the only reason I owned a PS4.
You know it's coming to Game Pass, right?
It's coming to Game Pass!
Yeah, Persona 5 Royal is coming to Game Pass.
Oh yeah, October 21st.
There we go. Just in time for Christmas.
But they haven't announced a date for the other two.
No, the other two are coming to PC and I assume also Game Pass. Persona 4 Golden seemed to imply
that on Xbox Wire.
Mm, yes, I think that was when, because that was when the big announcement happened. It was a while ago. It was one of the Xbox conferences. Yeah. They also announced Persona 4 Golden and Persona 3 Portable were coming to Xbox. We assume Xbox Game Pass sometime next year. So both of those games will be coming sometime next year. So the legal way you can play Persona 3 Portable is
just be patient.
Just be patient, yeah. Or just spend fuckload of money.
Or ultimately choose the more complicated option and purchase the original console for which the games were produced and then play it that way.
I also think they're probably quite expensive right now as well.
Yeah, that's the trouble these days. I'm not sure where the retro market sweet spot is at this stage in terms of like value. Like, we know that N64 games are expensive now, or for the most part, especially SNES ones, earlier than that, SNES ones. But where's the sweet spot? Like, are we up to the point where PS2 games are getting expensive?
PS2 games and GameCube games specifically have become very, or can be very expensive. I don't know how expensive Persona 3 on the PS2 is, because I've not seen it, quite frankly.
You're looking between 60 to 100.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Sounds about right for a PS2 game.
I've checked.
Fair enough. I don't know how much. Have you checked what the PSP version is? I don't know how, if that's more.
I don't intend to own a PSP.
I know, because to be fair, right? So with Persona 3, the best way to play that game is the PSP remake, not the PS2 original. Because the PS2 original is weird and you can't control your party members in combat.
I've watched the first couple of hours of the game to see if I would like it or not.
Mm.
And I think I would, so I stopped watching.
Sure.
And it looked like that it was just it was like a default setting that other party members would just attack freely, and I thought you could just change that.
I believe on the original Persona 3 on PS2, you cannot change that. But there is Persona 3 Fez, F-E-S, The Answer, or something, which also has the original version of the game on it.
Well, that was what I was planning. That was what I was planning on trying to get.
Yeah, you can change it on there, yeah.
Because obviously it's like an extended cut, isn't it? So like
it has like a sequel thing deal. It has something extra to it. Also, so Persona 3 is complicated. Persona 3 Portable also allows you to play as a female main character, and has lots of new content with the female main character. There's no definitive version of this game.
I see.
Yeah. Persona 3 Portable, the PSP game, is the one that is coming to PC and Game Pass and stuff like that. Like, whenever it is, later on next year.
I'm getting a real crash course in Persona 3 right now.
It's because I've been like, I've just been doing research, trying to find out ways that I can play it, because I don't know, man.
You came to me and was like, what's the deal with this game?
Feels as though that you're at your wit's end.
So the way to play P3 is incredibly convoluted and weird. I played it on my phone on an emulator about 10 years ago.
So the thing is, right, I don't want to spend a lot of money. I don't want to have to reacquire old hardware.
Yeah.
And
especially if you don't know if you will definitely like the game or not as well.
Yeah, that's another issue. So apparently, I was also doing some research.
Mm.
And do you have a PS3, Adam?
I do not know.
Okay, because people were telling me it exists on the PlayStation 3 online store.
Our friend Ryan has a PS3 and a copy of the game on his PS3. In a digital download folder.
So it does exist.
It does exist, yes. It does exist.
It sounds like the most cost-effective way for you to play it would be to borrow that PS3.
I don't know if I'm on borrowing PS3 terms with Ryan.
True, that's fair. I was on borrowing PS3 terms with Ryan. I don't know if I still am. Also, I don't know if he still has that PS3, which is a
Well, I don't know. He is known for not being wise with coins.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know if he still owns a PS3. Either way, you can play it on Game Pass probably at some point. That's probably the best way.
I mean, it strikes me that they'll do it in reverse chronological order, and therefore it'll probably be about Easter.
They will do it in reverse chronological order, yeah. Persona 4 Golden will be first, and then Persona 3 Portable will be just after that, I imagine. Wait. If you're okay playing the portable version anyway.
Why the portable version? That's so
Because you get to play as the girl.
That's such a weird pick.
I think it's the most complete version. No, none of those versions are complete versions of the game, like, are definitive versions of the game. P3P has the girl character, main character that you can choose, so you can date all of the boys if you want. And also, I believe, is the most recent release. So, I don't know. So, they just need to give you like a golden version of that series of that game, like all three games just thrown together so that you can get the best of all worlds. But this is Sega and Atlas, and I'm not in control of what they do. So,
what do you mean you're not? I was going to push you for a Shadow the Hedgehog spin-off from Sonic Frontiers.
We do need a... I mean,
whatever they could do with Persona 3 just won't make... But let's be honest, it won't make them enough money to justify them doing it.
I don't know. I disagree. I think it probably would. Persona's getting to be a big franchise now.
There was a lot of hoo-ha... Well, a lot of hoo-ha. A lot of praise for Royal, for sure, when that was being shouted about.
It was the best-rated exclusive PlayStation... best-rated PS4 exclusive. It's no longer an exclusive. Well, in October, it'll no longer be an exclusive. But it's rated higher than The Last of Us on Metacritic. So.
Strange.
It was. I think there's only, and I'm not looking at Metacritic. I'm just remembering. But I think there's only two or three games higher rated on it than Persona 5 Royal on Metacritic for PS4, and I think that's Grand Theft Auto 5 and Red Dead Redemption 2. And then I don't know what the third game is. It might be The Last of Us. They might be tied with The Last of Us. But yeah, it's like...
Which is interesting in a way, because you'd think that The Last of Us fan base would be particularly feral.
I'm not going off user reviews for this. I'm going off critic reviews specifically.
Right.
User reviews are interesting.
Unreliable.
Let's say unreliable. That's a good point. I don't know how do you make user reviews reliable on Metacritic? Do you just like
ban most of the users probably?
Everything that's a 10 and everything that's a 0 you just ignore completely. And then like find the median or like the average.
Maybe to like sign up as someone who can actually review. You have to complete a questionnaire, and there are like so many trap questions in there that like almost everyone gets filtered out.
Yes. I don't know. Metacritic user reviews, not my kind of thing. I don't want to look at it.
Well, be like me, Adam. Don't use Metacritic.
I don't typically use Metacritic, but I do find it interesting to look at like where games stand in the grand scheme of things.
I just think that a lot of the time that a Metacritic score won't be representative of what a person says. Like, I remember Yahtzee was once talking about this on one of his videos, because he wouldn't give games a score in his reviews because he thinks it's pointless.
Sure.
He thinks he always says you can tell from the way he writes his review whether he likes the game or not.
Oh yeah, of course.
You can tell can tell how he feels about the game within what he wrote about it. Yeah. But then he used to say, but Metacritic would just arbitrarily assign it a score anyway.
What?
Yeah, that's the trouble. That's the burden of being at a certain level of notoriety, I guess, within the industry.
From what I remember seeing about Metacritic scores and stuff like that, what they usually do is they ask the publication what certain scores mean on a scale. But yeah, if you don't give things a score and Metacritic really want to use your review, I don't know how they could score that. I guess that's just an arbitrary score, right? Or maybe they asked the Escapist, what does Yahtzee give this game? And they said, fuck it, I don't know, 6. And he's like, okay, cool. What's that then?
I just think, I don't know. I don't like the idea that everything has to have a score, because it just implies that people don't actually read reviews.
I mean, people don't. That's why scores are so popular, because people don't. Because people click on a review, they scroll all the way down to the bottom, and they go, that's a 6 out of 10. I'm not going to buy that. That's an 8 out of 10. That means it's bad.
3,000 words. Not going to read that.
I mean, precisely, right? And this is a weird thing that I'm taking here, but video games seem to be the only medium that have, like, essays as reviews. I even picked up, like, a newspaper and read like got to like skip to the like music review section or even the newspaper's game review section and yep. seeing that it's like it's just like a paragraph potentially too. And then
it's very true. It's very true. I used to do the student newspaper back at Preston Uni actually, and we did a variety of different reviews, and you're looking at like 100 words, 150 words,
yeah,
59 words in some cases. You know, for these, but obviously that was a smaller publication anyway. Sure. But like, you're right. Like, there's definitely a case for a like lengthier review, and generally when I do reviews. For games generally these days. I used to do ones for films back in the day, but you know, I'll sort of aim for kind of 500-ish words sort of thing, 500 to 800 words, because anything more than that you're just throwing your time away really. But also it's important to think about the fact that if it's a review and it's your opinion, which is generally what reviews should be rather than some sort of crusade as sometimes people will imply that you're making, then you should be able to make your points in that time. You know, you should be able to get across whether you like something or not in that amount of words. But I guess I'm still behind, or we still on Pass Controller use scores because it helps to give a point of comparison between different reviews on the site at a glance. So Metacritic aside, which we're not on anyway, it just gives, partly it gives me a reference point as well. When I'm looking back at, I don't know, past Assassin's Creed, for example, whatever, trying to see where a new release falls within the series for me, because that's the sort of question people might ask. It's just a temperature check to see, oh, okay, I really enjoyed that element, but not that element. And that meant that it averaged out to something around X.
I like scores in reviews. I enjoy giving things scores. I don't know why. I like having a score at the end of it going, yeah, this is a 9, or this feels like a 7, or this is a 3, or whatever. Like, I like using the whole range as well. I know some websites, some criticized more than others for not using the whole range. In particular. I like writing lengthy reviews as well, but you've got to have a word count. I think you've got to have a proper word count. Otherwise people.
Yeah. It just becomes indulgent at a certain point. Otherwise, doesn't it? If you're not putting any bounds upon that at all.
I think so.
You know,
I think so. But I really like, and there's a few things that I've seen. I remember seeing it in magazines, like way back when I was a kid. That's what I remember. I went blank for a minute. This game is better than, this game is worse than, this game is similar to another type of game. So like in I don't remember exactly what, like but in like a, let's use the Assassin's Creed reference, right? So someone's playing Assassin's Creed Valhalla and someone gives that score like a 75% or whatever, then they'll say Assassin's Creed Valhalla is better than Assassin's Creed Unity, probably, I don't know, but worse than Assassin's Creed Origins, whatever it's called.
Oranges, lemons, who knows?
Yeah, whatever. And I like having that state of comparison in reviews. And like when I'm reading reviews, having that state of comparison on the page, like on the side there going, well, we thought that this game was better than another game and similar to a different one, or like worse than it. So it might be worse than The Witcher 3. It might be better than flipping whatever, right?
Yeah,
and I find that far more helpful than I mean, because a score is perfunctory, isn't it? Really, because the person giving that score,
especially when you're comparing,
especially
when you're comparing games outside of or in separate genres as well, because like you know, you wouldn't, well, some people would, but like you, I guess you wouldn't compare, say, Limbo with, I don't know, FIFA.
Yeah, you can't.
Probably, you can't. Yeah. I mean, I can't think. I'm sure someone has done it somewhere.
Like, what are the parallels between Limbo and FIFA? I don't know. There are balls in them. No, you're right.
Like, are there? Just trying to think about where the balls in Limbo are.
I've not played Limbo, but that dude's head's a ball, so that works.
Are there any large spiders in FIFA that I'm not aware of? I haven't played since FIFA 99. Well, no, maybe I have, but properly I haven't played.
That's also
since
a good point. Maybe there are large spiders in FIFA worth talking about. I don't know.
I love Limbo. I'm not even going to hide it.
There's no need to hide it.
I really like Limbo.
Why would you hide your love for Limbo?
It's an indie darling. Surely it's acclaimed to the heavens.
Exactly right. Is it like saying, I love cake? Everybody loves cake.
Oh, yeah. And then there's the liars who say that they don't.
True.
If you say you don't like cake, you're lying.
I mean, surely, even if it is true, or they believe it to be true, the reality is that they just have not been introduced to enough different types of cake.
Exactly. Or the cake that specifically, like, there's so much cake out there. Like, you might not like vanilla sponge. Sure, whatever. Do you like chocolate? Yeah, all right, we'll have this chocolate cake because you'll like that. It tastes like chocolate. I'm very, very cut and dry about this.
I think we've outlined a clear agenda for the beginning of our cake-based political party.
Exactly. Cake or death. Oh, you choose death? Well, that's a shame.
Well, we only had two bits. We weren't expecting such a rush.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're getting elected next general elections, lads. Don't you worry. Our campaign.
We might. You never know. Hello, and welcome to Sometimes Video Games. I'm Adam, and I am joined, as per usual, by Louis Birtwistle. How are you today, Louis?
Oh, I'm all right. I'm a bit tired. I've been working hard, man.
Working hard or hardly working?
Working hard. My day job is brutal.
Yeah, it doesn't sound fun. I'm also joined by Pasta Controller's very own James Michael Parry. How are you, good sir?
Hello, hello. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone.
Wherever
I'm well.
It is you are. Good, I'm glad to hear you're doing well. Glad to hear you're doing well. You don't have a... When we talked about your day job last time, you were on the podcast. You have been on the podcast before. Welcome back.
I have. I'm now a repeat offender, officially. I enter that into the law book, please.
Yes, we need to. Yeah, that's a thing. We people on more than once, they're officially people in the law, I guess. Make up backstories for James, if you please.
You're practically a co-host at this point.
I mean, I think we have to, you know, we'll take all the suggestions in the comments, and I'll officially anoint one of them as, you know, valid.
The backstory of James.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Well, yeah, I'm glad that everyone's doing okay. What have we been up to? What are we doing? Other than working like a dog.
Working. Everyone's busy. Whenever you ask how people are, everyone's busy or busy. Or, you know, busy. It's the curse of the modern age.
It kind of is, you know. It kind of is. I feel like you're always just, if you're not busy, you're always busy, right? I don't even work and I'm busy.
I mean, I've made my last week more busy by taking time off work, because I chose to take time off my day job to head on down to EGX for a bit of gaming show in real life fun times.
Well, as it was called by us old people, Eurogamer Expo.
Indeed, yes. And whenever I'm explaining what it is to people who aren't in gaming, I have to, you know, explain the acronym in as if it is ever referred to as anything else, which is very odd. But yeah, went down there took a half day on Thursday, went down in the afternoon, and then all of Friday for a full-on gaming time. But then I did a load of, you know, interviewing developers and playing games and, you know, having thoughts about them and stuff. So now I've got loads more work to do. So
I mean, yeah, that's what you've done. You've made work for yourself.
Yeah, that's not good. But in a sense, in a sense, not in reality perhaps, but in a sense, I've been paid for my time while doing it because I was on holiday, if that makes sense.
True. I mean, that's, you know, it's always good. What did you see? What did you do? What did you see? Who did you speak to?
My goodness.
I realize that's a big question. There's a lot of these, yes.
Multiple questions. Well, basically, I had arranged to see a few specific games. It was very much an indie-focused show this time around, I think it's fair to say. There was not a lot of AAA madness going on compared to when I was there in 2019, when there was a huge Nintendo area, a huge Xbox area, a huge PlayStation area. There were no areas, so to speak, this time.
There was just dumped indie games everywhere, and you were
there was a section for Nintendo, and they did a Splatoon 3 tournament, and that was fairly large. But in terms of established, well-known titles, there was a section for Modern Warfare 2, which cheekily on Thursday was not open until 6 p.m. for some reason. I don't quite understand why. I don't know. And there was also a section for Wolang Fallen Dynasty, which I did play.
I don't know what that is.
So it's just gone away again now, but they did have a demo out on an Xbox PS5 or Series X and PS5 over the last week. So while we were at the show, people could have been playing it. And they were like, if you don't manage to complete the demo here, you can go home and finish it. Because, I mean, to summarize, I can't say I am in any way an expert on this, but it is very much a Soulsborne-inspired samurai flick. So I didn't play Sekiro, but I imagine that there are some similarities there. But in particular, the design of, well, you know, there's the telltale things like the placement of your health being the telltale
Souls. You look at the HUD and you go, oh, this is Dark Souls.
You're like, yep. But also the like boss design. There was like one boss at what I presume was the end of the demo, which I could not beat. Which is not a huge surprise to me at all. But the design of it was very much kind of, you know, you've got to parry, you've got to block, you've got to do whatever, you know, you're not going to brute force this kind of thing, essentially. And I think it was, and they were even giving out badges, you know, you remember badges.
Yeah, I remember those.
Which just said defeat on them.
Oh,
so
do they have ones for victory as well?
Yeah, that's what they're expecting you to see commonly. But also Sonic Frontiers was the other main AAA thing that was there.
I did see someone talking about Sonic Frontiers.
Yeah. But those aside, I met some lovely Indian smaller devs. So I met Amber Bear Games, who are making a game called Ascent, and as part of Transfuser, and also Lasagna Games, who are making a game called Grapple Gal, also in the Lasagna, maybe they are, but in the Transfuser mix, which I wasn't super familiar with, but is very much graduate focused. So they're a collection of ex-university graduates who have all had cool ideas for games, and they basically compete for some money to make them more of their game ultimately. So that was fun to explore some of those. Also spent some time on Goat Simulator 3. Which is very fun because it now has multiplayer.
Do we need a third one really though?
Well no, but we need a second one.
There was no second one.
Yeah, there was no second one. So this is the second one.
It's all a very clever marketing cheeky thing that they've done.
Yeah. They named it Goat Simulator 3, so you went, hold on a minute, there was a second one.
I still don't know how I feel about them adding a sequel for what was essentially a one-note joke that was fun for about 20 minutes.
I mean, I would agree. However, having played it, and by comparison to the first one, it is very much like, not so much Saints Row, but I guess, you know, a very sandboxy madness kind of experience, and because they put multiplayer in it and a load of mini games.
Yeah, I guess that's the justifier for Goat Simulator 2, as it were, would be it's Goat Simulator, but we added multiplayer to it now. Right? Like multiplayer is enough to warrant a sequel.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And to be honest, I mean I had a great interview with a guy called Stuart, who's the sound designer and composer for the game. As much as it has significant music, I couldn't honestly pick out the themes as probably as much as familiarly as he would be with them. But they're throwing a lot in there. He mentioned that the team had turned it up to 11, as it were. And that definitely seems to be the case in terms of how they have. Yeah. I don't know how they could possibly bug test that game. Like, it's so deliberately janky, it almost seems completely futile.
That's surely an incredible interview with the QA testers.
I know, that's a good point, actually. They're like, I'm at my wit's end, I think I'm a goat.
Yeah. That's just a day in the life of a goat simulator tester.
Imagine being a QA tester for that game. That'd just be such a terrible thing to have to do.
I mean, I don't know enough about QA in reality, but I do know a few people who do that sort of stuff, and how incredibly mind-numbing it is to record bugs and stuff like that, even in the sort of thing that I do professionally at the moment. It feels like it would suck all of the life out of gaming for me.
He's talking to a QA colleague at work. How did you spend your day productively today? I spent the entirety of this day walking into this wall to see if there was any areas where it didn't have collision.
Mm.
Please kill me.
At different angles and different heights and different speeds. And
different characters. If you're wearing this hat, can you get through the wall? If you're wearing this hat...
That is going to be
a list somewhere for sure.
When you boil down to it, it's excruciating, right? You've got to think about all of the little, every possibility, just every little possibility of,
which is why Ghost Simulator is so ridiculous to think about in those terms, because there is literally a particular, well, not so much a mini game, but I guess it's almost like a random event, if you like, context sensitive quest that you can activate, whereby if you grease up a particular machine with oil, then it fixes the machine, and then the machine in question either maximizes or minimizes, i.e. increases or decreases in size, whatever you put into it, including the goat. So if you just run through a machine 10 times, then you're the size of a house. And you can still get in a car and drive a car, and then your head is sticking out of the top of the car. And, you know, is that a bug? Probably technically, but in the context of this game...
You're probably not supposed to be doing that, but I mean...
Well, exactly, you know.
So who cares?
It certainly seemed to impress the team that I sort of combined those two things when we were doing it anyway. I'm sure it hasn't been done by now.
Sure, yeah. Maybe the first time they noticed it and gone,
yeah, exactly. I mean, people were doing all sorts of stuff, but that was a fun time. And then the other thing that I played, actually, which I haven't done for a while, was some VR, some virtual reality, because there is a new Peaky Blinders game called The King's Ransom, which is being made by a team called Maze Theory, who have done some Doctor Who tie-in VR content and some other cool stuff in the past. I've
heard of them before, yeah.
And so, again, I had to chat with one of the guys from there and went through their demo. And it's like a leap ahead of where I haven't played Half-Life Alyx, which I know is held up very highly in terms of VR experiences in general. But like, it's really a leap ahead of where we were before. I think I was using Quest 2. Or whatever we're on, but yeah, I think it's really incredible, actually, how much they've brought that platform forward, comparing to like the very first, you know, stuff that we had coming out about 5 or so years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting. To be fair, I've not got a VR headset. It's hard to imagine. I've used one once. At a place, and that was fun. I think Louis was there with us. I'm not sure, but
I was there.
I think it was good fun, but I don't know whether I would feel comfortable using VR in my own home and stuff. I'd feel weird.
I think it is very much a it's a very personal preference from a medical point of view, as it were, because you know, A, if you wear glasses, it's difficult.
Yes.
B, if you get travel sickness or motion sickness very easily, it can be not fun. However, I would say that because the fidelity of and refresh rates and stuff like that has improved, that sort of rolling shutter effect that you get when you move your head sometimes in older VR is kind of eliminated to an extent, at least now. But yeah,
I remember, yeah, the sort of being immersed stuff is, because I remember, I think I might have even said it a long time ago when, if ever we were talking about VR before, but we're playing the VR game, it's a shooting game, I can't remember what it is, you shoot robots. I remember like one of the big robot enemies just bashing into me and throwing me off the level, and me being in VR fairly immersed at this point, being like thrown off a level, I almost fell over in real life. Like I was like, oh god, I've lost my footing, this feels awful. Like a sudden stomach drop moment, like you're on a roller coaster, and then I realized that actually no, I'm not falling, I'm stood up in VR. So I can imagine how, like, just being like, in your own home or whatever, like, especially if you've got, like, pets or whatever just hanging around.
Yeah, it necessitates you having another room in which VR can be performed, basically. I think so. I mean, at least you don't have to set up sensors and stuff as much these days compared to when they were first coming out. But, yeah, it's still... I mean, to be honest, I was doing... So when I played through the Peaky Blinders game, I was pretty much stood still. Like there wasn't like a lot of movement, lateral movement, because you're still walking forward and backwards with a control stick and doing significant turns. I mean, you could just physically turn yourself 360 degrees, obviously, if you wanted to, but I tend to use a kind of, I don't know, I was turning maybe 90, 100 degrees in front of me. And then if I needed to turn all the way around, I used the stick to sort of jump around behind me to kind of make it easier so that I didn't feel like I was just like trotting around on the spot. But yeah, the gameplay has a big impact on how that feels, or how much you sort of have to move physically in the space to actually do it. Apparently I almost punched someone at one point.
Oops.
Oops.
Oh well, I mean, you didn't. The key word there is almost. So you didn't punch
exactly.
Anyone.
I think they were savvy enough
no
to get
charges.
Out of my way.
Absolutely, that's good. Do you? Have
but
any,
you would have punched them had they not have adjusted
had
their
they
position.
Not have moved.
You would hope. I mean, it's one way to teach, isn't it?
It is. It is. Do you have a game of show? Do you have a game that you were most impressed with when you were?
This is a good question. Actually, I haven't so far kind of put my finger on one that's like really head and shoulders above. I think as a concept and idea, and like just generally having spoken to the team, as I say, I think Ascent was definitely one that stood out, not just, as I said, to them, because both they and their studio are the start of the alphabet and therefore easier to remember when you're looking through a list of 1,000 games or whatever it is. But the idea, the concept of it was charming, and the, you know, the visuals were straightforward and not kind of polished, because that's not the stage that these games are at, you know. No. But I think because I'm always impressed when a game is not, you know, combat focused and feels like it legitimizes itself well, you know what I mean? Like it's not as if you've taken a game, you've taken combat out, and you've got what's left, because I think, you know, not all games should be, you know, shoot someone in the face kind of experiences. I mean, for some people that's enough, and that's fair enough. Obviously, everyone can enjoy whatever they wish, but I feel as though when there are experiences which are a bit more kind of varied from that point of view, you can get some really interesting things coming out. And I think what was interesting about this concept was that So in a nutshell, the like fire as a element on Earth has basically been extinguished, and there are all but one flame remains in the world or something, and you are tasked with restoring this flame in the the village that you're in, basically. So you have to go around and complete various kind of mini quests or things which will start to restore the balance. And it's very kind of, you know, nature driven and regional history, cultural driven, that sort of thing. And I think that that was what made it kind of the most memorable. But there was also games at the show, obviously, that are probably already out. And that's the kind of weird thing about some of these shows sometimes, is that you just stumble across games that are like, oh, well, actually, I could get this on Steam on the way home, but I didn't know anything about it beforehand. Curse of the Sea Rats was one which definitely stands out from a... It's got a good visual, hand-drawn style to it, and a kind of, again, a straightforward concept. In a nutshell, you are, you know, a bunch of pirates who are caught in a storm and cursed, as you might infer from the name, and they're turned into rat people.
There's a difference.
That's true. I mean, I guess rat people in the sense that they're wearing clothes. So
Are they rats in clothes? Do they shrink down to the size of rats?
Well, that's what I don't quite know. I'm assuming that they must be shrunk down, because you are at certain points fighting like crabs and stuff. So they must be shrunk down.
Sure.
But that was just a game that looked really polished. But again, it would look polished if it's been released. So I guess that's not as fair a benefit to give. But that was a good one. I think, to be honest, the King's Ransom VR, as a VR experience, it's probably one of the best I've ever played. It has the benefit of being newer than most other VR experiences I've had, but
sure.
The team has clearly thought it through a lot, and they've used the IP well. It's not just been stickered on top of something that they were already going to do. You know, they've thought about this from the ground up.
That's always the best way to approach, I think, those kinds of games. Like, licensed games is just so, you know, from the point where you're like, okay, I want this to be as it is.
So, speaking about VR for a second, like, how are you on terms of the whole motion sickness thing?
For me personally, I haven't had a problem with it.
So I know that is like quite an issue for quite a chunk of people.
Yeah. I think as the headsets themselves get lighter and, you know, there's less cables and stuff to worry about, but also the actual ability to engage like an AR view so that you can see the world around you to an extent and stuff like that, which is, it depends on the actual device, of course, but the fact that there are more options for that now, I think hopefully that means the general approachability of VR is improved from that perspective.
Because, well, I know the main issue and what causes motion sickness is either, you know, it's movement which is seen but not felt, or movement which is felt but not seen. It's like, so obviously in a VR game, you can see the movement, but you just can't feel the movement.
Yeah.
So I wonder how people who do have issues with motion sickness are actually even able to play VR games.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's really a way around it ultimately, because it's the same as, like, you know, any given roller coaster or whatever. If you go on a roller coaster, you're going to experience certain forces and certain physical things which are unique to that experience or those range of experiences. And for some people, it's just like, nope, you know, can't do it. You know, for whatever reason.
That'll certainly be a shame if VR gets really good.
Yeah, I mean, I think arguably it already has, and that's still a problem, if you like, because it's a combination of medically there are barriers for people in terms of accessibility or approachability.
Yeah,
and also from a disability point of view, there are accessibility issues, I'm sure, but also it's prohibitively expensive still for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think
I feel like it needs to have its breakthrough moment, really. Because it's not something that a lot of people own. It's not something a lot of people even can own.
Yeah, I still feel like VR, for as many leaps and bounds that it has come forward in, is still kind of not necessarily in people's homes. Like, people might have like a PlayStation VR, maybe, if they've got a PS4 or PS5. But I don't know. I personally only know one person with a VR headset, and like they're in games design, so that's like, it's kind of part of their job. I don't think I know anybody else personally with a VR headset, or is even thinking about getting one. Like it doesn't have its killer app. Well, it, not for the public, I don't think either. Like Beat Saber was one of those big ones that people were, oh, I want to get that for them.
That's still going as well. Like you see that all the time.
But other than like Beat Saber and like playing Skyrim in VR, because you know you need that many more ways to play Skyrim. It doesn't seem to be on people's radar, I don't think.
Like thing is with the, I remember when VR was first ever being talked about, and I once said, and I might have been wrong on this, but I still feel like there's a chance for me to be right.
Sure.
But I feel like I'm definitely wrong. I once compared it to, I thought it would have the same life cycle as the 3D TV did, which was, okay. It was just too much of a hassle for people to set up and just deal with and own, to the point where people just wouldn't use it. Because the point of like most, you know, people who play games on a console, you can jam in a disc or whatever and you're in the game. You don't have to think about it, you don't have to worry about it. And for a lot of people who still aren't technologically savvy, they just want to enjoy the experience without having to work for it.
I still see it as an equivalent of like the Wii and the Kinect and stuff like that, right? And those sort of motion control things, in that they never really took off, even when there were big games using motion controls as their major usage, as their major way of playing the game. They didn't take off because people, quite frankly, people who love video games, quite frankly, don't want to stand around and like work out while they're playing a game.
It takes more than the bare minimum amount of work, and I feel like that's kind of not acceptable for something that is just purely recreational.
Like, a lot of people don't want to stand up and play like first person shooters or whatever, right? They want to just sit there in their pants with a packet of crisps and do the headshots or something. I don't know how first person shooters work, but you know what I mean? Like, people, like, I've busted up my knee today, and I've just been sat there playing Stardew Valley in bed, and like people don't, I wouldn't want to play VR Stardew Valley where I'm in the farm and like I have to dig up the crops or whatever. I wouldn't want to do that for more than 5 minutes, because one, that would be horrifically painful to do for me, and two, it doesn't sound like fun.
It sounds like being an actual farm, which is,
I mean,
exactly, that's the thing, isn't it?
Physical
barriers to entry are the most felt in general. Like, often that's the case, and you see this in, like, I don't know, even event design and like queue design and stuff like that around places, because if people are lazy, and people will go like the easy way around, even if the perceived more difficult way around is actually the easier way, you know. So in terms of VR, I mean, I think, so if you take the King's Ransom as an example, I mean, so A, like a lot of good VR games these days, you get the option of whether you want to stand up or sit down, so that's good.
Yeah, of course.
But also, you have to look at that game experience and say, okay, if you just took the VR away and you plugged in a mouse and keyboard or a controller for this, would it be the same, or would it be just as good, and therefore why would I care about VR? So in this case, the immersion of the game is tied to the VR experience. So I think that's part of the strength of it as a game, like not just a quote-unquote VR experience, which I think a lot of things are. A lot of things in VR are tech demos or whatever, you know, not properly fully developed things. And again, in this case, you know, I played you know, a reasonable length demo, and like only a kind of percentage of it was like gunplay and shooting people and stuff like that. It was, you know, a percentage of that experience, not the kind of main thrust of it, which I think is interesting because you're getting into more kind of, you know, almost, if you think about maybe reminding me a little bit of like Deus Ex or some of the more recent Deus Ex games, whereby obviously you can take a gung-ho approach and shooting people in the face or whatever, but you can talk people around and stuff like that. And when it comes to VR, you've got that sort of immersion of, you know, you can pick up a bottle of whiskey and you pour yourself a drink and pour someone a drink and, you know, have a cigarette or whatever and have a kind of conversation. I don't think that this game in this case has like a kind of, you know, dialogue tree series of options like a Mass Effect style thing or whatever, but you could see a world where, say, you know, apply that to like the concept of cyberpunk or something, whereby it's a very RPG focused experience. Could be really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. It could be. And there are so many barriers to entry, as we've said.
Whether it ever will, for exactly that reason. Will. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll. It is to be seen. But personally, yeah, I keep sort of going back to the Wii comparison more than anything, and just thinking, well, I enjoyed playing Twilight Princess, but I'd rather play it on a controller.
But the thing is, the Wii was so successful, though. That's why all of the others tried to copy it.
The Wii was so successful because you could get grandmas bowling in a care home. It wasn't successful because people loved the one-to-one sword play of Zelda Skyward Sword or whatever the fuck Red Steel did.
With the Wii Remote Plus add-on thing.
They didn't want that. They wanted Wii Sports and Wii Fit and Wii Boxing and other stuff, you know.
It's because the controller fundamentally and historically the concept of a controller has often been a barrier to entry for people gaming, and when you only need to move your wrist ultimately, not even your body, then a lot more people are opened up to that. And I think that, you know, we won't see I'd be very surprised if we saw a sort of revolution in control schemes like we did with the Wii again, just because that sort of ship has sailed. But I think there is certainly I can definitely see a world where, whether it's Nintendo, whether it's someone else, comes back around to some sort of a, you know, thing which taps into a different area of the non-gaming market and it opens it up to them.
Yeah, I can see it happening. Like VR, like VR chat to a way, in a way, right? VR chat is such a weird, I guess, piece of software, because it's not even really a game. It's a thing where you go in and chat with people. And I've seen, so it's like taking over like examples of streamers, right? So there's a streamer called Iron Mouse who is a VTuber. She can't leave the room that she's in because of a medical condition. And so playing something like VR chat gives that accessibility to her to move around or not touch people, but feel like she's touching people because she's not able to, you know, physically touch people in real life and stuff like that. And I feel like there's obviously that level that VR can improve someone's life by allowing them to do things that they wouldn't normally be able to do. And that sounds amazing. Like, I can't imagine being able to, I can't imagine a person who's never left their house, right, putting on a VR headset and putting on like a graphically superior version of Skyrim and being able to walk around on like a one-for-one level and go, oh wow, look at that. Oh, this is, you know, this is how it feels to be outside or whatever, right? I feel like that's kind of where I expect VR to go in terms of that, because I feel like the there are limits to what it can do in video games that aren't just I'm picking up a controller and putting a thing on my head.
Yeah, definitely from a medical and therapy kind of point of view, there seem, and even educational, actually, I can imagine there'd be a lot of applications to it. And that's one of the biggest benefits of the fact that the technology is, although still, as I say, pretty expensive, a lot more accessible to people than it was, even to, say, to schools or whatever. I'm sure that Meta do deals for, you know, education and that sort of thing.
We can only hope.
Come on, Meta, pull your finger out.
I know. Come on, what's this all about? I haven't played much in terms of video games this week. I've been a bit all over the place, but I don't know. I don't know video games, man. Video games is such a weird concept. Louis, what do you think? Video games as a concept?
I guess. I mean, are they weird?
We rebooted. We've gone back to the beginning.
Yeah, let's do it. Video games. Weird. Why are they not weird?
I couldn't really explain to you. To be honest, it's all I ever experience is the world through video games.
Shit. That's...
So you are the VTuber in this story.
The difference is I have a 9-to-5, and you know I have to go outside, and I don't have the luxury of being.
I wish Louis was a VTuber, like a proper VTuber, like as a little magical girl or something.
Oh, I get like a voice changer.
Yeah.
And I put on like this the magical girl voice or whatever.
What's your best magical girl voice, Louis?
I'm not doing that for you. That is gratifying only for you, Adam, and you know it. I am not doing that for you. I am not a piece of meat, Adam.
Fair. You're right. Fair enough. I apologize. That was selfish of me, you're right. It is selfish of me to wish you was a magical girl. I don't know. Video games are it's rough. It's rough. I think it's rough to do all sorts of stuff. Like, to be a Twitch streamer and stuff like that is not always the easiest job, as we've seen from lots of people.
There's a lot of the discourse going on around that at the moment, isn't there? These companies have a huge influence over people's lives by the fact that they can change a few percentages here and there and really mess with people.
I have seen the stuff about the is it the percentages that streamers are getting paid now. I think
ultimately, I couldn't recount accurately the differences between the before and the after, but I think ultimately it's a case of they could have made a call which was people first, but they chose to make a business first decision instead.
I think we're seeing more and more. Twitch is that kind of business, or rather, like it's Bezos and Amazon, right? Amazon owns Twitch, yep. Doesn't it? So we're seeing more and more that Amazon is that kind of business, I think. And I think there's also this point that Twitch hasn't been making money, like, because I think a lot of it is just paid out to its user base, right? Or like 50% of whatever users get.
I think that's probably where. Although Amazon bought a kind of profitable business at the time because of the way the audience or the streamers themselves have matured, I don't know. They're probably not making as much, or they're not being able to exploit as much as they could previously without changing the rules in their favor. So there we are.
So a lot of people moving over to YouTube, which I don't see it being an ultimately successful move, because YouTube, as we know, can be just as bad.
I mean, I think the bigger issue is that it depends on the like the individual. You know, a lot of people can't afford to just leave a platform, you know, because they've established a community and an audience.
If you're let's say you're a medium sized channel, right? Because if you're a big channel, if you're a massive streamer, you're getting less money. But at the end of the day, that doesn't really matter to you. As like, if you're the biggest if you're like, what is it? Is Ludwig the biggest streamer on the platform? If you're Ludwig, right, you're just getting like, you're getting a pay cut, and getting a pay cut sucks, but you're also already like a millionaire, so.
Yeah, but I mean, then you have examples like Ninja, where he left Twitch to go to Mixer, and it killed his career.
It did, but I guarantee that he's not suffering. Oh,
he's not poor. He's not poor by any means, but he's not.
Exactly.
He's not, you know, pumping the numbers, as we would say.
But he's not.
Would we say that?
Some people might. Louis would say pumping the numbers.
I would not get that, Adam.
No. But like, and if you're a small streamer, I think one, it sucks having to rebuild your base. But two, you're not ultimately earning all that much money from Twitch as it was. I don't know how.
I mean, I guess so, but it's hard. That discounts the kind of emotional impact of that.
Not trying to discount the emotional, because I imagine it's really like, if you've got like 300 followers on Twitch or whatever, and you're making £50 a month, $50 a month or whatever, and you're like, hey, I've got this like small community around me, and they want me to do well and stuff like that. I don't know if ultimately Twitch's decisions affect you if that's the case, but like, you obviously don't want to just up and ditch Twitch as a platform if it's been successful for you. But like, I think if you've gotten as far as you can, as far as you have, then there's definitely a potential for you to get that far again. I think there are people who are earning a living off Twitch that aren't like multimillionaires at this point that are really going to suffer the most, I think. But I don't know who that could be. I don't know what that means. You know, I don't know what that looks like. A person who makes their living off Twitch, but isn't like one of those crazy rich influencer people that we know of. You know,
I guess the funny thing from my point of view is that even though I've been playing games since like 1992, but like I've been kind of engaged with the industry for probably 10-15 years at this point. I don't know if I could tell you what the life cycle of a typical streamer, if there is such a thing, is in terms of these platforms and in terms of how they, you know, grow and change, and if they reach a certain point, as you say, or if they, you know, their life changes and they, you know, they give up streaming and they move on, whatever. Because there's a lot to be said for the sheer amount of churn, if you like, going through. You know, you're always seeing, well, not always, but I'm often seeing people tweeting and then being recommended to me as a topic via video games or whatever on Twitter, where it's like, I've just reached affiliate. Oh my God, you know, and which is 100 followers and some other things, I should say. But, you know, how sustainable is it for them to keep on handing out affiliate to, you know, X 100 people a month? Like, how does that churn through? Is it just people, are there people burning out on the other end?
You mean in terms of the streamer itself, how, Or in terms of Twitch?
Well, both, I suppose. Like, they're individually, like, are there people who are stuck at, like, affiliate level and they're just, you know, they don't break out because there's so many people at that point? And
of course, there are definitely saturation. People who are at affiliate level who don't grow any further than that, who get to affiliate and don't grow any further. Or there are people that I know that I don't think have had a single payment off Twitch. You know, I think there are people that have gotten to affiliate and continue to put the work in, but haven't, for whatever reason, you know, managed to elevate their streaming career any further than that. I think those people, it depends on you as an individual, right? Because I think there's definitely some people who are very determined, who sit there and go, look, I'm an affiliate, this can work any day now. Or, I don't know what to play. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to create an entertaining stream, but I'm going to continue making what I want to make and not getting anywhere. I think those people definitely exist. And I think there's a lot of that kind of person out there who's gotten to that through one way or another, right? Through either cheating the system or through getting friends to help out or through, you know, like getting all sorts of other reasons, right? You can get to affiliate. It's not too difficult to get to affiliate, right? You can get there any number of reasons, any number of ways. It's the thing that's more difficult is continuing your upward progress from there, I think. Because I think for so many streamers, getting to affiliate feels like such an unattainable goal. But then you get it really quickly. Like, you,
like you'll start gaining followers and viewers and stuff like that, and then all of a sudden, like just after a month or so, you'll just be like, oh, I'm an affiliate now, without even really realizing it. And then from there, the goal is, well, what's next? I don't know. Make money? What? Do the same thing we did? But the thing that you've been doing over and over and over and again has only been good enough for you to get, what, 100 followers or whatever, not to the levels where you can actually physically get paid. Because 100 followers aren't going to... Your 100 followers are never going to watch you. Like, let's say 10% of that does.
Yeah.
That's true. A decent... 10% is probably higher, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing about it. It's not just... I mean, you could apply this theoretically to a lot of different things around success, to be honest. Mm. Because I think I saw a meme on the subject at one point for streaming in particular, whereby, you know, there's a timeline of streaming, and like, you know, the first 80% of the time is nothing happens. Like, you know, you're pouring time and effort and energy into this thing and nothing happens. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get anything back out of it, not just a payout, but just, you know, as you say, things trickle up and you're just not really seeing anything from it. And a lot of the time, well, many times in the past, there are people who are just, you know, a week away from some big moment where, you know, the algorithm aligned in their favor, or the game that they were playing had some news at the right time or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they get a bump, but, you know, you just don't know when that thing's going to come. And it's very demoralizing to sort of work on anything for a certain period of time and, you know, not really see or feel that you're moving forward.
It absolutely is. I think you can say, I mean, we've done it through here. We've managed to get to affiliate on Twitch through the three of us playing random stuff. How we managed to get to affiliate defies all expectations, basically, because we haven't focused on any in particular thing. We've just gone, screw it, let's just play stuff together and see what happens, right? Which is the absolute wrong way to do it, and we got incredibly lucky. Let's play GeoGuessr today, because, like, we can't be bothered. But, like, I think a lot of people, especially variety streamers, would really struggle to hit affiliate, because, it's got to line... Everything's just got to line up. Like, everything's just got to line up. And if everything lines up, and if the stars... stars align, then you'll just suddenly go boom, right, with our affiliate. But the stars don't align for everybody, right? The stars, you know, they just do their own thing, and you've got to be like the right person in the right time, playing the right game in the right kind of way, just for that like little push for you to get there. And it's such a weird, like, for me personally, it was just playing Hollow Knight, right? And I was streaming Hollow Knight, and I didn't have a lot of people turn up and say, you know, hi or whatever. I was just streaming Hollow Knight on my own. I was loving it because I it was the first time I played Hollow Knight, and I ended up falling in love with that game. But I was thinking, oh, when do I stream? What do I stream? So I started streaming at a specific time, and then starting seeing more and more followers just like seep through playing in the morning instead of in the evening, for example. And then all of a sudden, just like I one stream, like 20 people popped in and they were like, hey, you're an affiliate now. I was like, oh God, okay. What's just happened here? That was weird. That's a surprise, you know? And for everyone that I know who's sort of reached it, I think they just kind of got lucky in that way, right? In that they were doing something and then all of a sudden something happened and a bunch of people rushed towards and went, oh, this is interesting what you're doing now.
And it's weird, isn't it? When you can't sort of put your finger on exactly what or why or how that, you know, that moment is. And it's even like, you know, you see it in a similar sense whereby people like explode on on social or something goes viral or whatever, and you're like, what did they do? What you know?
Viral tweets always get me a bit like, why has this gone viral? Why am I seeing this? Yeah. Why does this have 100,000 likes? What's going on? And then why does this have like vibrator commercials underneath it? You
know? Oh God.
They kind of, viral tweets kind of confuse me because someone can post something on the most relatable level and it do nothing. Or someone can post something like absolutely just out of this world strange and everyone just retweets it and goes, yeah, this I agree. Or whatever. Just like, what do you mean? What? I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is like this sort of flash in a pan, the sort of lightning in a bottle, right? You can't capture that. You can never recreate that to your own liking, right? You can never go, haha, lightning in a bottle, I've made it. Right?
Yeah.
Let's make another lightning in a bottle happen because it
just
because
you're not in control of the lightning ultimately. You're only in control of the bottle.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you can put your bottle out there as much as you like, but it's only a chance that the lightning is going to strike and that's it. And you've got to just, I guess, in terms of streaming or in terms of anything really, literally in terms of anything, I guess, right? I guess we're sort of broadening the subject to success in whatever way. You've just got to keep on doing the things that you think, doing something that you think is good, right? Because I think there's a point where you're doing something for the heck of it, for the sake of it, and just going.
And that's it. And then it's really the case. It's really thinking about how you value success yourself. Mm. You know, ultimately, like, and I think for a lot of people, you know, so yeah, for some people it is monetary gain or whatever, but for a lot of people it's, you know, it's happiness, it's enjoying what you're doing and feeling like, you know, feeling good about what you're doing for yourself, and ultimately if other people love it and, you know, and then even better. But that's the biggest thing about, you know, I've been doing Pass the Controller now since about 2016 or something like that. I've never made never made money from it, never kind of broken out, never had some ridiculous brand approach me with some ridiculous deal, you know, or anything like that. But ultimately I don't mind because that's never been my focus or my measure of success. It's always been down to, you know, what I enjoy doing. And also it allows me to continue to have a great relationship with the hobby that I love and have loved for many, many years at this point.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a weird one. Success.
It's hard.
It is hard. You're not wrong. It's hard. It's really hard. Success is hard to get. It's hard to gauge.
Unless you're wealthy.
Unless you're wealthy. unless
you're wealthy. What if you're wealthy but sad and broken and dead on the inside? You're like, I'm still wealthy, I can buy new insides. Yeah, that's true, I guess.
Andrew Tate.
Why did you mention him?
I'm so wealthy, but I can't. No one loves me.
Oh, I'm so wealthy, but all of those trafficking allegations are really bumming me out, man.
He's just in his like fake American British. I hate his accent, man. I never know where it's going. Yeah, he's just like, I don't know. Success is a weird one. I guess if, like, yeah, because the idea is the ideal. So, James, for example, ideal that you can live off what you do, or is the ideal you just go, I don't care. I just want to enjoy, I just want to make what I want to make.
So, but the point there where I'm at, so I'm going to be 35 at the end of this year. And I know that if I really wanted to make a career out of either the site that I currently run or the video game industry in general, I would have need to have made different choices by now.
Sure.
I don't think it's impossible. And certainly there are plenty of people who I know who have made a career change at 40 and they've got into the industry and that, you know,
you've missed the 30 under 30 barrier.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that's part of it. But also, it's a case of what you want to sacrifice, because when you do a career change, you have to start from the beginning again. Yeah. Ultimately, like, there's no way around that. And and from my perspective, that's not something that I want to do. That's not a sacrifice that I'm willing or able to make financially or whatever. So that's my decision made, if you like. So in terms of video games, I will always be, you know, I always wonder if, oh, I don't know, if I had specifically gone after video game related stuff after I left uni, for example, I don't know. And like, I applied to be a writer at like Official Xbox Magazine about 5 times at one point. If I'd, you know, if one of those 5 opportunities had come through, I could have been in like official games press and doing other stuff or whatever. But it's just not the path, you know, it wasn't my path, and that's fine. And I don't resent that at all, because I'm particularly lucky, but also very happy with where I am at the moment. And that's, you know, that's where success comes in for me, you know. From my point of view, I've got the freedom to explore the video games industry and be part of it as much as I want to, almost to an extent. And I'm very lucky that I've got the freedom to, you know, to have good relationships with a lot of the publishers and platform holders and stuff, and get hold of stuff and, you know, try things and get new experiences that I wouldn't have unless I was doing all of this. And it ultimately subsidizes my hobby, if you like, rather than it being a career and absolutely what I do. It's just something that I, well, not just, but it's something that I do that I'm very passionate about, and really, you know, I make work for me, if you see what I mean.
I do, I get you, yeah. It's not what you do, it's not even who you are, it's something you enjoy doing. It's not your career,
it's an aspect of my personality that, you know, gaming is a concept, if you like, as I say, since 1992 or something. So Mega Drive 2, Sonic 2, Future Rage 2, everything 2 for some reason.
All of the twos.
You know, that's where it all began for me, and ever since it's been a constant. Like, you know, I've been in and out of other I guess interests, and, you know, even stuff like music. Like, I'm in a band at the moment, but like in the past I wasn't in a band, but I've always done gaming at every point of my life, really. So I know that it's not really going to go anywhere, and even if I end up not having time to do, say, you know, weekly console gaming that I do at the moment, in the future, because my life changes, there'll be something that I do connect with, whether it's like a mobile phone thing or, you know, it's just different. You know, it's all, the opportunities of gaming are nearly infinite at this point.
I mean, they are as well. Yeah, they actually are pretty much infinite. You can play games anywhere, which is, you know, right. No, I think I agree. I think I agree, and I think I understand what you're saying. Okay, I understand. I'm also getting to this is more of a sort of a personal, I guess, an interesting question that I wanted to sort of launch at you, because I wanted to know where you saw that success in your own thing, considering what you've been talking about, and about how you were talking about how you've been doing this thing, so doing Pass the Controller for so long, and that it's not sort of given financial success in a way, and how you see that as successful in your own terms, and how that works, because there's lots of stuff that I want to do, and I'm not too much younger than you, only a couple of years younger than you, and I'm obviously at the point in my own life where I'm like, okay, but what do I do? What do I want to do? What do I want to be? What do I want to, you know, throw my life into? What do I want to see as a success going forward? And because there's always so many avenues I feel like I should or could go down. But I feel like none of them are successful at this point. I don't know how to make them successful in a way that would make me happy. But not just that, but to a point where I'm not like financially in like the gutter, right? Because I guess that's kind of, I'm an odd person, and I find it very difficult to do certain things, and especially, so I've been in decent jobs before, I've been in good jobs before, and the last job that I was in was a very, very good job, a very well paid job. But one that ultimately had very severe impact on my mental health because of its public-facing role, essentially, dealing with lots of very serious and important issues with the general public, and ensuring that, you know, people don't suffer, and then hearing that people suffer every day on the phone kind of gets to you after a while.
Yeah. Of course.
So you I guess with me it's this sort of complicated combination between the idea, the concept of success in terms of financials, the idea and the concept of success as an emotion, as a contentedness, and then additionally just knowing that I can keep it all together, and like the ideal is something that can amass the three of those things, or combine the three of those things. But I'm getting to the age where I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can. Should I just do something else? Should I, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird. It's weird.
I mean, I think that, I mean, there's no single amazing answer for this, but no. I think the reality of that sort of situation, because I think it's, as you say, it's something that I could certainly relate to. The most successful people that you come across in general, so not as specific to gaming, not specific to any given industry, are people usually who invest themselves fully in a certain thing, right? And I'm the same as you in the sense that I'm a bit of a generalist. Like I say, it goes back to my training to an extent, because I went to university to do journalism, which is essentially learning to be, you know, the jack of all trades and master of none.
Yes.
And the unfortunate side effect of that is that I've got a lot of transferable skills, which means I can do a lot of different things, but I'm not necessarily looked to as a thought leader or a expert in any one of them. Because that's just not my business, if you like, you know? So in terms of the predicament that you present, it comes down to, are you willing to look at all of the, you know, say there are 10 things. If there are 10 things that you have played with the idea of doing, maybe, are you willing to shut down, well, either all but one of them or all but two to three of them, maybe maximum, to focus on just going down one avenue at a time? Because ultimately, if you don't make that sacrifice, then you will always be holding yourself back from the success that you're looking for.
You're spreading yourself too thin, and then you're unable.
Exactly, because time is limited, and people, like, you know, I had a conversation with someone at work the other day who said, "How do you do all these things that you do?" And I was like, "Honestly, I don't know, but I think part of it is that I think I'm energized and spurred on by the variety of the way that I do things. If you see what I mean. So the fact that I'm, you know, I know in any given week, I might have a band practice on one night, I might have a video to edit on another, I might have a, you know, be going to see a film or something in my own personal life, doing a family thing, doing a, you know, this big work thing. And it's the variety of the experience which is what keeps me energized to do all of those things. But ultimately, if I wanted to be just a, you know, video game superstar or whatever, I would need to stop spending the spare time that I'm spending on these five other things and invest it in that, because that's the only way that it would work. Financially, there's another element to it, in the sense that to take that risk is a risk, and I think that it should not, obviously it shouldn't be something that's taken lightly. But you know, there are ways of getting, you know, loans and whatever to actually start. I've thought before about, you know, should I, maybe not just sort of quit my job outright, but like, should I stop doing what I'm doing as a day job, take out a loan or get investment backing to plug everything into PTC and see if I can make something of it, and all this sort of stuff, you know, is that what I really want? But I think ultimately the reality is that I like the point that I'm at already, and I think to do that would be impressing a outsider's perspective of success on what I'm doing, whereas the only important measure of success is your own.
And yeah, that nothing truer can be said than that. Like, that you're correct, the most important measure of success is your own. I know so many people who judge themselves by where other people, I do it as well. I feel like everybody does it to some degree, right? I feel like everybody does it to some degree. They look at someone else and they go, you know, I feel like I should be in that position, or why am I not in there? Why, you know, that sort of thing, right? Why am I not where this person is? I feel like we all do it. But that's not how you should measure your own success, because your own success cannot be measured with them, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. And I think that, you know, that it almost, that's the quickest way to unhappiness, or away from the happiness that you would hopefully associate with success, is to live in a world where you're only comparing yourself with others, and only being like, well, why do they deserve to break out on Twitch, or why do they deserve to, you know, make it big doing this, or why do they get the opportunity to start that new job that I could have gone for, or even that you applied for in some cases, you know. I've definitely been guilty of that in the past, whereby I've, you know, I've applied for that staff writer job multiple times, and then like the new person starts and I'm like, well, you know, what have they got? You know, what are they?
Yeah.
You know, why are they all that? Why am I not all that? But, you know, at the end of the day, the choices that I've made in my career have led me to a point where I'm in a role at a company where I have never been happier and never been, possibly never been more successful, if you like, at what I do, but not by my, in that case, not by my standards, but by the company standards, in terms of I've, you know, had great response to the work that I do. But more importantly for me is that the response from the company that I get for what I do is, you know, fulfilling and builds me up. It doesn't tear me down, you know? And I think that's probably the main reason that I've left other businesses in the past, because I appreciate not everyone has the luxury of being able to, you know, turn down things and that sort of thing as well, of course. But, you know, I've been in a position where I knew that I wasn't happy and work was part of what wasn't making me happy. So I had to make that choice. And ultimately it's led me to somewhere where I'm a lot better off. So that's why I say I've been very lucky.
I feel like we got a little bit too deep for that last like half an hour of podcast, but I feel like it's been a very interesting and enlightening conversation. I don't know if anybody else thinks that as well, but I don't know.
I'm glad you think so.
I think it was right good.
It was right good. There we go.
Oh yes, bring it back. Bring it back.
That's all that matters. I got to thank you, James, for joining us on Sometimes Video Games. Where can people find you if they want to find more of your stuff?
I am at James_Parry because I made my Twitter into the world in the land many years ago when underscores were cool. So James_Parry on Twitter, and you can find Pass the Controller at passthecontroller.co.uk or .com. Go nuts, pick whichever.
Is it at both?
It's at both.
Oh, that is magic. That's incredible. So you don't even have to worry about the .com.
Exactly.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us, and also, thank you everyone who stopped by for a listen. Really appreciate you coming by. If you did enjoy the thing that you just listened to, you can always give us a follow or a like or a heart or whatever it is on your platform of choice. We're available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, other places as well. So feel free to do whatever it is that you need to do there. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.